who by then had been living on their street for a month. Although Nath had not yet come to hate him, he already sensed that they would not be friends. At 7, Jack was tall and lanky, freckled and bold, afraid of nothing. James, not attuned to the sensitivities of the playground, was suddenly annoyed at his son's shyness, his reluctance. The confident young man in his imagination dwindled to a nervous little boy, skinny, small, hunched so deeply that his chest was concave. And though he would not admit it, Nath, legs twisted, stacking the toes of one foot atop the other, reminded him of himself at that age.
"We came here to swim," James said. "Mrs. Allen is watching your sister just so you could learn the breaststroke, Nathan. Don't waste everyone's time."
He tugged the towel from his son's grasp and steered him firmly toward the water, hovering over him until he slid in. Then he sat down on the vacant poolside bench, nudging aside discarded flippers and goggles.
"It's good for him," James thought. "He needs to learn how to make friends."
Nath circled the girl who was it with the other children, bouncing on his toes to keep his head above water. It took James a few minutes to recognize Jack, and when he did, it was with a twinge of admiration. Jack was a good swimmer, cocky and confident in the water, weaving around the others, shining and breathless. He must have walked over by himself, James decided. All spring, Vivian Allen had been whispering about Janet Wolfe, how she left Jack alone while she worked at the hospital.
"Maybe we can give him a ride home," he thought. "He could stay to play at our house until his mother finishes her shift."
He would be a nice friend for Nath, a good role model. He imagined Nath and Jack inseparable, rigging a tire swing in the backyard, biking through the neighborhood. In his own school days, he'd been embarrassed to ask classmates to his house, afraid that they'd recognize his mother from the lunch line or his father from mopping the hallway. They hadn't had a yard anyway. Maybe they would play pirates, Jack as the captain and Nath as the first mate. Sheriff and deputy, Batman and Robin. By the time James focused his attention back on the pool, Nath was it. But something was wrong. The other children glided away. Silently, stifling giggles, they hoisted themselves out of the water and onto the tile surround. Eyes closed, Nath drifted all alone in the middle of the pool, wading in small circles, feeling his way through the water with his hands. James could hear him.
"Marco! Marco! Polo!"
the others called back. They circled the shallow end, splashing the water with their hands, and Nath moved from one side to the other, following the sounds of motion.
"Marco! Marco!"
A plaintive note in his voice now.
It wasn't personal, James told himself. They'd been playing for who knows how long. They were just tired of the game. They were just messing around. Nothing to do with Nath.
Then an older girl, maybe 10 or 11, shouted,
"Chink can't find China!"
And the other children laughed. A rock formed and sank in James's belly. In the pool, Nath paused, arms outstretched on the surface of the water, uncertain how to proceed. One hand opened and closed in silence. On the sidelines, his father, too, was uncertain. Could he make the children get back in the pool? Saying anything would draw attention to the trick. He could call his son. "It's time to go home," he might say. Then Nath would open his eyes and see nothing but water all around him.
The smell of chlorine began to bite at James's nostrils. Then, on the far side of the pool, he saw the blur of a body sliding silently into the water. A figure glided toward Nath. A sandy head broke the surface. Jack.
Polo! Jack shouted.
The sound echoed off the tiled walls.
Polo! Polo! Polo!
Giddy with relief, Nath lunged, and Jack held still, treading water, waiting until Nath caught his shoulder. For a moment, James saw sheer joy on his son's face. The dark furrow of frustration wiped away. Then Nath opened his eyes, and the glow vanished. He saw the other kids squatting around the pool, laughing now. The pool empty except for Jack in front of him. Jack himself turned to Nath and grinned. To Nath, it was a taunt.
Joke's on you.
He shoved Jack aside and ducked underwater. And when he reemerged at the edge, he climbed straight out without shaking himself. He didn't even wipe the water from his eyes, just let it stream over his face as he stalked toward the door. And because of this, James could not tell if he was crying. In the locker room, Nath refused to say a word. He refused to put his clothes or even his shoes on. And when James held out his slacks for the third time, Nath kicked the locker so hard he left a dent in the door. James glanced back over his shoulder and saw Jack peeking through the door from the pool area. He wondered if Jack was about to speak, maybe apologize. But instead, he stood silent and staring. Nath, who hadn't spotted Jack at all, marched out into the lobby, and James bundled up their things and let the door swing shut behind them. Part of him wanted to gather his son into his arms, to tell him that he understood. Even after almost 30 years, he still remembered P.E. class at Lloyd. How once he'd gotten tangled up in his shirt and emerged to find his pants missing from the bench. Everyone else had already dressed and was stuffing gym uniforms into lockers and lacing shoes. He had tiptoed back into the gym, hiding his bare thighs and calves behind his knapsack, looking for Mr. Childs, the P.E. teacher. By then the bell had rung and the locker room had emptied. After 10 minutes of searching, mortified at being in his undershorts in front of Mr. Childs, his pants were revealed under a sink, legs tied around the U-bend, dust bunnies caught in the cuffs.
"Probably just got mixed up in someone else's things," Mr. Childs had said. "Hurry along to class now, Lee. You're tardy."
James had known it was no accident. After that, he had developed a system. Pants first, then shirt. He had never told anyone about it, but the memory clung. So part of him wanted to tell Nath that he knew what it was like to be teased, what it was like to never fit in. The other part of him wanted to shake his son, to slap him, to shape him into something different. Later, when Nath was too slight for the football team, too short for the basketball team, too clumsy for the baseball team, when he seemed to prefer reading and poring over his atlas and peering through his telescope to making friends, James would think back to this day in the swimming pool, this first disappointment in his son, this first and most painful puncture in his fatherly dreams. That afternoon, though, he let Nath run up to his room and slam the door. At dinner time, when he knocked to offer a Salisbury steak, Nath did not respond. And downstairs, James allowed Lydia to nestle against him on the couch and watch the Jackie Gleason show. What could he say to comfort his son? "It will get better." He could not bring himself to lie. Better just to forget the whole thing. When Marilyn arrived home early Sunday morning, Nath sat sullen and silent at the breakfast table,
and James said merely with a wave of the hand, "Some kids teased him at the pool yesterday. He needs to learn to take a joke."
Nath bristled and glared at his father. But James, cringing at the memory of all he had left out, "Chink can't find China," didn't notice. And neither did his mother, who, preoccupied, set bowls and the box of cornflakes in front of them. At this last outrage, finally, Nath broke his silence.
"I want a hard-boiled egg," he insisted.
Marilyn, to everyone's surprise, burst into tears. And in the end, subdued and unprotesting, they all ate cereal anyway. It was clear to the entire family, however, that something had changed in their mother. For the rest of the day, her mood was sulky and stormy. At dinner, though they all anticipated a roast chicken or a meatloaf or a pot roast, a real meal at last, after so many Swanson's dinners warmed in the oven, Marilyn opened a can of chicken noodle soup, a can of SpaghettiOs. The next morning, after the children went to school, Marilyn pulled a scrap of paper from her dresser drawer. Tom Lawson's phone number still stood out, sharp black against the pale blue college rule.
"Tom," she said when he answered, "Dr. Lawson, it's Marilyn Lee."
When he didn't reply, she added, "James Lee's wife. We met at the Christmas party. We talked about me maybe working in your lab." A pause. Then, to Marilyn's surprise, laughter.
"I hired an undergrad months ago," Tom Lawson said. "I had no idea you were actually serious about that, with your children and your husband and all."
Marilyn hung up without bothering to reply. For a long time, she stood in the kitchen by the phone, staring through the window. Outside, it no longer felt like spring. The wind had turned biting and dry. The daffodils, tricked by the warm weather, bent their faces to the ground. All across the garden they lay prostrate, stems broken, yellow trumpets withered. Marilyn wiped the table and pulled the crossword puzzle toward her, trying to forget the amusement in Tom Lawson's voice. The newsprint clung to the damp wood, and as she wrote in her first answer, the pen tore through the paper, leaving a blue A on the tabletop. She took her car keys down from their hook and lifted her handbag from the entry table. At first, she told herself she was just going out to clear her head. Despite the chill, she rolled the window down, and as she circled the lake once, twice, the breeze snaked its way beneath her hair to the nape of her neck.
"With your children and husband and all."
She drove without thinking, all the way through Middlewood, past the campus and the grocery store and the roller rink. And only when she found herself turning into the hospital parking lot did she realize this was where she'd intended to come all along. Inside, Marilyn settled in the corner of the waiting room. Someone had painted the room, walls, ceiling, doors, a pale, calming blue. White-hatted, white-skirted nurses glided in and out like clouds, bearing syringes of insulin, bottles of pills, rolls of gauze. Candy stripers buzzed by with carts of lunch trays. And the doctors? They strode unhurried through the bustle like jets cutting their steady way through the sky. Whenever they appeared, heads turned toward them. Anxious husbands and hysterical mothers and tentative daughters stood up at their approach. They were all men, Marilyn noticed. Dr. Kenger, Dr. Gordon, Dr. McClenahan, Dr. Stone. What had made her think she could be one of them? It seemed as impossible as turning into a tiger. Then, through the double doors from the emergency room, a slender, dark-haired figure, hair pulled back in a neat bun. For a moment, Marilyn could not place her. "Dr. Wolf," one of the nurses called, lifting a clipboard from the counter, and Dr. Wolf crossed the room to take it, her heels clacking on the linoleum. Marilyn had seen Janet Wolf only once or twice since she'd moved in a month before, but she would not have recognized her anyway. She had heard that Janet Wolf worked at the hospital. Vivian Allen, leaning over the garden fence, had whispered about late shifts. The Wolf boy left to run wild. But she had pictured a secretary, a nurse. Not this graceful woman, no older than she, tall in black slacks, a white doctor's coat loose around her slim frame. This Dr. Wolf, a stethoscope looped around her neck like a shining silver necklace, who with expert hands touched and turned the bruised wrist of a workman, who called clear and confident across the room, "Dr. Gordon, may I have a word with you about your patient, please?" And Dr. Gordon put down his clipboard and came. It was not her imagination. Everyone repeated it, like a mantra. "Dr. Wolf, Dr. Wolf, Dr. Wolf." The nurses, bottles of penicillin in hand, "Dr. Wolf, a quick question." The candy stripers as they passed by, "Good morning, Dr. Wolf." Most miraculous of all, the other doctors. "Dr. Wolf, could I ask your opinion, please?" "Dr. Wolf, you're needed in patient room 2. Only then did Marilyn finally believe. How was it possible? How had she managed it? She thought of her mother's cookbook. "Make somebody happy today. Bake a cake. Bake a cake. Have a party. Bake a cake to take to a party. Bake a cake just because you feel good today." She pictured her mother creaming shortening and sugar, sifting flour, greasing a pan. "Is there anything that gives you a deeper sense of satisfaction?" There was Janet Wolf striding across the hospital waiting room, her coat so white it glowed. Of course it was possible for her. She had no husband. She let her son run wild. Without a husband, without children, perhaps it would have been possible. "I could have done that," Marilyn thought, and the words clicked into place like puzzle pieces, shocking her with their rightness. The hypothetical past perfect, the tense of missed chances. Tears dripped down her chin. "No," she thought suddenly. "I could do that." And then, to her embarrassment and horror, there was Janet Wolf before her, bending solicitously in front of her chair. "Marilyn," she said. "It's Marilyn, right? Mrs. Lee?" To which Marilyn replied the only words in her mind. "Dr. Wolf." "What's wrong?" Dr. Wolf asked. "Are you ill?" Up close, her face was surprisingly young. Beneath her powder, a faint constellation of freckles still dotted her nose. Her hand, gentle on Marilyn's shoulder, was steady and assured, and so was her smile. "Everything will be fine," it seemed to say. Marilyn shook her head. "No, no, everything's fine." She looked up at Janet Wolf. "Thank you." And she meant it. The next evening, after a dinner of canned ravioli and canned vegetable soup, she planned it out in her mind. She had all of her mother's savings, enough for a few months. When her mother's house was sold, she would have more,
enough for a few years at least. In a year, she could finish her degree. It would